audible. Over his shoulder, his PowerPoint slides flashed on a small movie screen. Pak Army's Contributions, Silent Surge, read the title of one slide. Its bar graph showed that the number of Pakistani soldiers and paramilitaries deployed to the federally administered tribal areas had grown from just under 40,000 after the September 11th attacks to more than 140,000 by 2009. The silent part of the surge reflected Kayani's reluctance to trumpet these figures in Pakistan, which might aggravate the Pakistani Taliban and other local insurgents by disclosing the scale of the army's occupation of the tribal areas. Pak Army's Contributions, Military Casualties, flashed next. The slide reported that terrorist attacks and fighting in the tribal areas had killed more than 2,300 Pakistani soldiers through early 2010 and injured another 6,800. Nearly all of the casualties had occurred after 2006. A third slide showed that during the same period, there had been more major terrorist incidents inside Pakistan than in Afghanistan or Iraq. Kayani refrained from saying what he, Pasha, and many other Pakistani generals believed. Pakistan had paid a higher price than the United States for joining the post-September 11th alliance against the Taliban. And now it was being rocked by the spillover of America's failed invasion of Afghanistan, against which Pakistan had warned. The ISI's support for the Afghan Taliban's revival, if the generals acknowledged it at all, should be understood as a defensive measure, an effort to push the violence caused by America back across the border into Afghanistan, rather than as a covert offensive aimed at retaking Kabul. Kayani flashed a slide showing a blown-up building in Lahore. It was a regional office of ISI bombed by former allies of the spy service who had turned against the Pakistani state. The casualties endured inside Pakistan since 2006 included dozens of ISI officers, Kayani said. ISI could not possibly be fomenting terrorism if its officers were also victims of terrorism, he argued. 80% of ISI officers came from the army. I know how ISI functions and how ISI operates, Kayani said. The service is aligned with army policy. He displayed a slide showing Tiger Woods at the top of his golf swing in his signature red shirt. Kayani went into his thesis, by now familiar to Admiral Mullen and other American interlocutors, about the fundamentals. He compared the pursuit of stability in Afghanistan to a sound golf game. One fundamental was the internal discipline and morale of the Pakistan Army. A second was public opinion in the region and America. He concluded by defining what the Army and ISI sought across their western border. A peaceful and stable Afghanistan, a friendly Afghanistan. Given the ISI's history, it was hard to avoid hearing this formulation as code, once again, for Pakistani influence through the Taliban. Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif, the former Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, who had helped select Mullah Muhammad Omar as the movement's emir, lived in a two-story concrete home at the end of a muddy road in the Khushhal neighborhood of Kabul. He had painted his house green. Pashtuns dominated his neighborhood. A small shack occupied by armed NDS soldiers guarded Zaif's front door. One morning during the first week of April, one of the former ambassador's sons greeted an American visitor and showed him to an upstairs sitting room. As tea was prepared, young children and teenagers wandered in and out, practicing their English. The house was cold and modestly furnished. There were green curtains and green light fixtures with ornamental shades designed as tulips. The bookshelves held leather-bound copies of the Quran, the Sunnah, a Webster's English Dictionary, and a French translation of Zaïf's recently completed memoir, Prisonnier à Guantanamo. It was Zaïf who had put the Germans in contact with Tayyip Aga, Omar's envoy. After the Germans reported their secret meetings with Tayyip Aga to Holbrook, Zaïf organized an unpublicized nighttime meeting at Kabul University that brought together former Taliban office holders and Mike Flynn, the ISAF intelligence chief, to explore the possibilities of negotiations. Zaïf understood from the Americans and Europeans he met that the CIA and the Pentagon presented the greatest obstacle to developing peace talks. "I think the European countries are interested in stopping war and finding an alternative," he said after the tea arrived that April morning. He was a large, soft man. His untamed beard was jet black. "It's just the Americans. They are ready to fight, and they seek to defeat the Taliban by force." He outlined his version of the Taliban's negotiating position. Foreign troops had to leave Afghanistan. The Taliban should be removed from blacklists and given an address, a safe office, from which to negotiate. The movement did not seek the overthrow of the Karzai government, but would seek amendments to the Constitution that would bring the country into line with the Taliban's understanding of Islamic law. This would not require a return to all the old social rules of the 1990s, when Afghan women and girls were deprived of education, he emphasized. The Taliban would negotiate with fellow Afghans and Muslim scholars to define a new era of women's access to work and education in concert with Islamic law. "The people of Afghanistan, they are Muslims, and nobody is rejecting Islam here," he said. "This is very easy for the people of Afghanistan to come together and solve this. America came here for what? They came for women? No. They came for education? No. They came because they were attacked from Afghanistan, and they sought security. This is their right. But they should not occupy or interfere with Afghanistan." The Taliban had perhaps 25,000 or more men under arms that spring, concentrated in the south and east of Afghanistan. Many high-ranking leaders lived with their families in Pakistan. There they operated training camps. Some of them traveled to the Gulf on Pakistani passports, operated businesses and hospitals, or smuggled war materials to the battle lines inside Afghanistan. The revived Taliban could be described as decentralized because commanders exercised considerable autonomy. These fighters included many young men who had no memory of the Islamic Emirate of the 1990s, as well as some opportunists who engaged in racketeering and other crime. The movement could also be described as centralized because its Rabari Shura, commonly referred to as the Quetta Shura, and headed, at least notionally, by Mullah Muhammad Omar, appointed and removed governors, supervised the war through a military commission, and issued written policies on everything from smoking to the avoidance of civilian casualties. It was not easy to gauge opinion among frontline Taliban commanders, but by 2010, independent scholars, journalists, and researchers, as well as NATO military analysts, had conducted extensive interviews with some of them. In a classified report, "The State of the Taliban 2009, an American military task force interviewed Taliban prisoners about their motivations and beliefs. In essence, the survey found, the prisoners opposed all foreigners in Afghanistan, including Pakistanis. The Taliban believed they were winning the war, that they had not been defeated in 2001, and that they were thrown out of power illegitimately." Obama read this document in the winter of 2010 and told his aides it was one of the most interesting and useful things he had seen in a long time. The Taliban of 2010 differed from the movement of the 1990s. Alex Strick Van Linschoten, a British scholar who had lived in Kandahar after 2001 and interviewed many Taliban, emphasized that the resistance to American occupation occurred because of the restoration of corrupt, predatory pre-Taliban strongmen such as Gul Aga Sherzai and newer figures such as Ahmed Wali Karzai. The Taliban saw themselves as heirs to Afghan resistance to the British Empire, followed by the Soviet occupation, and now followed by the American intervention. In the context of the American invasion of Iraq, the narrative of Islamist resistance to American occupation of Muslim lands offered a fresh international context for the Taliban's resistance. Also, Taliban leaders forced into exile in Pakistan after 2001 were exposed to diverse strains of Islamist politics they had previously ignored or disdained when they were mired in the Islamic Emirates' obscurantism. These Taliban leaders joined a wider international discourse after 2001 about the diverse strategies of Islamist revolution. They absorbed the examples of negotiation and proselytizing advocated by the Muslim Brotherhood and the case of Hezbollah's tactical power-sharing in Lebanon. The expansion of the movement's political imagination after 2001 and the openness of at least some leaders to negotiations with the United States was partly due to the embracing of information technology and the free media, as one Taliban leader put it, which led to the circulation of the diverse ideas. Another factor was a lesson learned from the Islamic Emirates' overthrow. If the movement came back to power, it would be better if it was not sanctioned or illegitimate in the eyes of the international system. Barnett Rubin argued that there was clear evidence that the Taliban were open to political compromise. The position of some CIA operators in the region, including Chris Wood, was that the Taliban saw negotiations as merely a diplomatic annex to their military campaign. The purpose of talks, from the Taliban's perspective, might include dividing European governments from Washington or hastening an American withdrawal. But Mullah Muhammad Omar would never accept the compromises necessary for a political agreement to end the war, these skeptics argued. The possibility of direct talks with Tayyip Aga at least offered a path to clarify the puzzle of Mullah Omar's position in the war. In shadowy exile, he had been portrayed by Taliban and Western media as a kind of fire-breathing, screen-projected figure, heard from in periodic statements, never seen. An arrest in Karachi in the winter of 2010 further scrambled the picture. The CIA base in Karachi had expanded to include about 36 case officers and assignees from the NSA, Special Operations Command, and other agencies under an agreement worked out with President Asif Zardari and Pasha at ISI. In February, the base traced a phone call to a house in Baldia town, a neighborhood in the city's Pashtun-dominated western reaches. Pakistani forces raided the home and arrested Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, whom the Taliban described as Mullah Omar's principal deputy. American targeting information led Pakistani police to the address, but the Pakistanis did not know who they had arrested until the Americans informed them. The U.S. side emphasized that they were certain of Baradar's identity and pressed the Pakistanis to keep the Taliban leader alive. "If you kill him, we won't understand." The ISI transferred Baradar to a prison. The service's media wing told the local press that they would not allow the CIA direct access to the prisoner, an assertion of nationalist prerogatives. In fact, Pasha soon allowed CIA officers from the Islamabad station to speak with Baradar, but only under ISI guard, as an officer involved described it. The truths Baradar could tell about ISI, not to mention other Pakistani notables, a cable from the U.S. Embassy in Kabul noted, made Baradar a dangerous prisoner for Pakistan. ISI pressured and even tortured significant Afghan Taliban leaders. On March 5, 2010, Obaidullah Akhund, a former defense minister for the Islamic Emirate and a field commander after 2001, died in Pakistani custody, reportedly of heart disease. Former Taliban leaders believed it was almost certain he was beaten or tortured to death. The ISI also arrested Gul Aga Ishakzai, a former head of Taliban finance that had been placed on sanctions lists by the U.S. Treasury. When they released him in December 2009, Ishakzai flew from Karachi to Mecca, where he entered a Saudi hospital with life-threatening injuries inflicted during beatings in ISI custody, according to reports relayed by the Saudis. For Afghan Taliban who fell in ISI's crosshairs, Pakistani prisons are worse than Bagram or Pulicharki, meaning the dungeons run by the NDS, as Wakil Ahmad Mutawakil, the former foreign minister, explained to NATO interlocutors. It was almost impossible for the United States to discern which ISI arrests of Taliban leaders were designed to give the appearance of cooperation with Washington, and which were carried out to punish Taliban clients who had fallen out of ISI's favor. The two categories were not mutually exclusive. "We have 11 offices that are with you and one that's against you, so be careful," ISI officers explained to Taliban commanders, according to a NATO intelligence collector. It took months, but NATO's intelligence services gradually documented the leadership succession at the Taliban's highest levels that followed Baradar's arrest. Mullah Abdul Qayyum Zakir ran the Taliban's war as the head of its military commission. He was a Helmandi who had been sent to Guantanamo early in 2002, but assumed a false identity and fooled American authorities into releasing him late in 2007, after which he returned to the Afghan battlefield to seek retribution. As Baradar's successor as deputy emir, the Taliban promoted Mullah Akhtar Mansur. During the 1990s, Mansur had held positions in Taliban aviation, including at the state-owned Ariana Airlines. This placed him at the center of Taliban finance, because Ariana was the Islamic Emirates' supply lifeline, operating shuttle flights to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. Those governments, with Pakistan's, were the only ones in the world to recognize the Islamic Emirate as Afghanistan's legitimate regime. Mansur, an ample-bellied man in his late 40s, traveled more frequently than other Taliban leaders to the Gulf, and may have had business or financial interests there as well as in Pakistan. According to what the Obama administration pieced together, money was another factor in Mullah Mansur's rise to prominence during 2010. Previously, a Taliban aide named Aga Jan Motasim had carried out Taliban fundraising in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. He was close to Baradar. During the summer of 2009, Mullah Muhammad Omar, or someone acting in his name, removed Motasim from this role. There were rumors that Motasim had not accounted properly for every rial he had collected. Later, when he was campaigning to replace Mullah Omar, gunmen ambushed and wounded Motasim in Karachi. He fled to Afghanistan and then to Turkey to recover in a hospital there. It was around the time of Motasim's removal that Taliban leaders had informed Saudi intelligence that Tayyip Aga would be their new international and fundraising envoy. Tayyip Aga told his European interlocutors that he was in direct touch with Mullah Mansur. All that could be said for certain was that Motasim and Baradar were out, and Tayyip Aga and Mullah Mansur were in. Tayyip Aga was a relatively young man, believed to be in his 30s or early 40s. He said he was from a family of Sayyids, or descendants of the Prophet, from around Kandahar. He was related by marriage to Mullah Omar. During the last years of Taliban rule, Tayyip Aga had been visible in Kandahar as a personal secretary to Omar, as well as a translator and press spokesman. He spoke English and Arabic, and occasionally spoke for the Taliban to the BBC. He had also played a liaison role with Arab fighters then in Afghanistan. Because of his youth and lack of battlefield credentials, Tayyip Aga lacked gravitas, but he had a documented record of proximity to Mullah Omar. As the Obama administration collected these biographical details early in 2010, the National Security Council designated Tayyip Aga as one of several threads of possible contact with senior Taliban leaders. At some point, it also became clear that the Taliban had formed a committee to handle liaison and possible political negotiations with the ISI, a committee headed by Mullah Muhammad Abbas Akhund. The underground senior leadership of the movement was organized enough to establish separate diplomatic strategies and liaisons for the United States and Pakistan. Pasha flew to Washington in April. At Langley, the ISI chief met Leon Panetta in the director's dining room on the seventh floor of old headquarters. Steve Kappas, the CIA's number two, had informed Panetta and the White House that he planned to retire in May. It was a personal decision. His first grandchild was about to be born, and he wanted to leave the CIA before he started to lose a step. His departure meant the seventh floor would lose its most experienced Pakistan specialist. Panetta had, however, decided to recruit John Bennett, the former Islamabad station chief he had cursed out in 2009, to run the National Clandestine Service. "You really ought to be thinking about talking to the Taliban, because you guys are leaving," Pasha now advised them. "You should cut a deal now. We need to be part of that deal." Panetta was skeptical about talking to the Taliban through any channel. But after the White House digested the German reports on Tayyip Aga, President Obama authorized a classified initiative to explore what might be possible. On April 20, 2010, Doug Lute convened the Conflict Resolution Cell, a highly compartmented interagency group designed to evaluate and coordinate possible political negotiations with the Taliban. The White House wanted strict secrecy because they weren't highly confident about their plan and didn't want to raise expectations before they made progress. Lute chaired the cell's weekly meetings in a secure conference room. Holbrooke, Chris Wood, Michelle Flournoy, who was the policy chief at the Pentagon, and David Sedney, now one of Flournoy's deputies, attended the meetings. Rubin and a few others on Holbrooke's staff also attended often. There would be four cornerstones to the administration's approach to peace talks, Lute announced at the first meeting. Any talks had to be Afghan-led. To encourage that, the cell quickly abolished the Bush administration's restrictions that theoretically prevented Hamid Karzai's government from talking to 31 named blacklisted Taliban and other armed opposition leaders. They also adjusted the positions the Bush administration had set for any negotiations. Under Bush, as a precondition to any talks, the Taliban had to break from Al-Qaeda. It could not be incorporated into Afghan politics under arms. And the Taliban had to accept the Afghan constitution. The conflict resolution cell changed these from preconditions for talks to goals of a successful peace negotiation and political settlement. Clinton added a phrase about all Afghans enjoying equal human rights, an indirect reference to the status of women. This would be part of the goal of Taliban acceptance of the constitution. Potentially, Holbrooke said, the work ahead could be historically important. An immediate question was what to tell Hamid Karzai about the administration's willingness to talk to the Taliban. The Afghan president was due to visit Washington in May. His trip offered an opportunity to repair the damage done by the 2009 election fiasco. The conflict resolution cell had glimpses of ISI's campaign to reel Karzai in that spring. They believed Karzai favored talks with the Taliban. Offering support for talks might help to steer Karzai back to the American camp. Holbrook told his aides that he favored small steps. We get in trouble when we say we want a peace deal with Mullah Omar. Petraeus advocated waiting until 2011 to consider talks so that American forces could batter the Taliban and win defections. Reuben quipped, negotiating when leverage is at the maximum is like selling your stocks at the top of the market. It's desirable, but not easy to do. Negotiating takes a long time. We are already late if you want to be negotiating at top leverage. Tom Donilon, the deputy national security advisor, appeared at the next meeting on April 27th and again 2 days later when the cell reassembled. What should they tell Karzai? Holbrook objected to Petraeus's timetable. We will be lame ducks by the beginning of 2011, he said. The real issue is, should we accelerate? This schedule is too slow. It will take a long time. The Taliban want to talk to the United States, Reuben emphasized. Chris Wood agreed. He had met with Taliban commanders through the CIA's channels, and they want to hear it from an American. We can provide safe passage to organize talks, and not confuse that with a ceasefire. Pakistan wants to control this, Holbrook reiterated. Yet the cost of any political deal with the Taliban that was influenced by Pakistan, said Sedney, would be the risk of civil war in Afghanistan. The former Northern Alliance leaders and large sections of the Afghan population would convulse if they believed ISI had authored a peace deal that returned the Taliban even partially to power. The United States was in a difficult position, Sedney continued. ISI believed the United States had aligned with India and the Northern Alliance to win a military victory that would leave Afghanistan hostile to Pakistan. Simultaneously, Hamid Karzai interpreted Holbrook's embrace of Kayani and Pasha, the strategic dialogue, and the flags and flowers tours of Washington that spring as just the latest evidence that the United States planned to sell Karzai's government out and cut a secret deal with Pakistan to exit the war. If they could not somehow resolve this chronic, triangular mistrust, they were unlikely to succeed at war or at secret diplomacy. Chapter 25 Kayani 2.0 Faisal Shahzad, the son of an Air Force vice marshal, enjoyed the privileges and mobility common to families of senior Pakistani military officers. He studied at English language schools in Karachi. He earned a Master's of Business Administration in the United States, married, fathered two children, and took a succession of corporate jobs in Connecticut, including one with Elizabeth Arden. Around the time he became a naturalized American citizen, at the age of 29, in 2009, Shahzad had grown disillusioned with the United States. He had suffered personal setbacks. He borrowed to buy a house, but lost it to his bank during the Great Recession. Increasingly, he felt called to jihad against his adopted country. He decided to wage war, he explained later, until the hour the U.S. pulls its forces from Iraq and Afghanistan and stops the drone strikes in Somalia and Yemen and Pakistan, and stops the occupation of Muslim lands. Late in 2009, Shahzad contacted the Tehrik-i-Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, the confederation that had murdered Benazir Bhutto. He traveled to Waziristan, stayed about 6 weeks, learned to build bombs, and accepted $5,000 in cash to cover expenses for an attack inside the United States. He flew back to America on February 2nd. His family left for Pakistan. In late April, Shahzad bought a used Nissan Pathfinder, a sport utility vehicle. He packed its rear gun cabinet with white plastic bags of explosive fertilizer. He also installed 2 5-gallon canisters filled with gasoline, 3 canisters filled with propane, and 152 M88 fireworks. He fused his vehicle bomb to a pair of alarm clocks. On the afternoon of May 1st, 2010, Shahzad drove to New York City. He brought along a 9mm Kel-Tec rifle folded up in a laptop case in the event he had to fight the police. Around 6 p.m., Shahzad parked near the corner of 45th Street and 7th Avenue in the heart of Times Square. It was a warm evening. Revlon had sponsored its annual Run Walk for Breast Cancer earlier that day, drawing tens of thousands for an opening ceremony that had featured Jimmy Fallon. Run Walk volunteers still mingled with thick crowds of tourists as the sun fell behind the Hudson River. Shahzad kept the Pathfinder's engine running, grabbed the bag holding his rifle, and walked toward Grand Central Terminal, listening for an explosion. It didn't come. He was a poor bomb maker. The car smoked, drawing the police, who quickly ordered an evacuation. When the bomb squad eventually broke into the vehicle, officers found an incriminating car key Shahzad had left behind. The police traced him in 2 days. On May 3rd, the FBI discovered his name on the manifest of an Emirates Airlines flight from New York to Dubai. They stopped the plane as it taxied toward a runway at John F. Kennedy International Airport. Shahzad soon pled guilty and was sentenced to life in prison. The near miss jolted the Obama administration. The previous Christmas Day, a Nigerian jihadi loyal to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, in Yemen, had tried to blow up a Northwest Airlines passenger jet as it landed in Detroit. The suicide attacker's bomb, stuffed in his underwear, had fizzled. Now again, just 5 months later, the White House found itself one mediocre terrorist away from a bloody made-for-TV crisis. If Shahzad's bomb had gone off, the fact that his attack had been prepared and funded in Waziristan could have forced the Obama administration into an escalating military confrontation with Pakistan. Republicans in Congress, seeking to take back the House of Representatives during an angry midterm election year, would likely have demanded action. Heavier bombing inside Pakistani territory, special forces raids, or even an American ground invasion to clear out Taliban and al-Qaeda training camps. Shahzad's fusing failure reduced the pressure, but did not eliminate it. How should they convert this crisis into an opportunity? Perhaps if Kayani and Pasha truly believed that another terrorist attempt on American ground might lead the United States to war against Pakistan, they might at last reconsider ISI's position. This was perhaps the best leverage they had, short of breaking relations. Some of the Pakistan hands in the administration thought of it this way. They wanted Kayani to wake up every morning concerned that this was the day the United States had lost patience and decided to come after Pakistan. Stan McChrystal and Carl Eikenberry worked closely with Hamid Karzai to prepare for his state visit to Washington, scheduled for May 10th. Holbrook flew out to Kabul to join the preparations. Throughout, Karzai failed to mention that he was in private contact with Pasha and ISI. On May 9th, Pasha flew secretly to Kabul and rode to the Arg Palace for what Karzai described to the Obama administration, a few days later, as a 12-minute one-on-one discussion. To some of Karzai's aides, who later briefed American counterparts, the visit seemed to be Pasha's latest opaque effort to recruit the wobbly Karzai to ISI's priorities. It isn't fully clear what Pasha and Karzai discussed. Pakistan wanted peace and stability in Afghanistan, Pasha assured Karzai again, according to one account. Pakistan would not submit to pressure by others, meaning the United States. You are the president of Afghanistan, and we support you, Pasha said. The next morning, Karzai boarded a U.S. military transport for the long flight to Andrews Air Force Base. That evening, at Blair House, Hillary Clinton hosted a state dinner. Only then did Karzai mention Pasha's latest visit and entreaties. As Vikram Singh, one of Holbrooke's aides, put it, ISI's plan was to recruit Karzai to work with Pakistan exclusively, and then bring the United States in after a peace settlement with the Taliban had been forged. The Obama administration's plan, on the other hand, was to talk to the Taliban in secret about a settlement, then bring ISI into the picture afterward. In this tug-of-war, Karzai looked like a kind of floppy rag doll holding the middle of the rope. Pasha had another agenda during his briefly secret visit to Kabul. The ISI worried, because of the Times Square bombing attempt, that Karzai would defame Pakistan repeatedly during his state visit, and perhaps rally Obama into action against Islamabad. To preempt that, Pasha offered Karzai partnership without conditions. It was an effort to persuade him to bite his tongue while in Washington, Karzai's chief of staff, Umar Daudzai, thought. On May 11th, Karzai joined Clinton, Lute, Holbrooke, and other American officials at the State Department. It seemed clear that Karzai imagined he had great leverage and was cleverly using his indecision to extract concessions from the United States. He seemed unaware that what he was really doing was driving the Obama administration mad, undermining the president's faith in the cause of an independent, democratic Afghanistan. Karzai's tone was both friendly and threatening. Afghanistan needs to rally people against extremism and for partnership with the U.S., he said. We will pay a price and work with the U.S., but only if Washington was invested in Afghanistan for more than just a war on terrorism. It's not just the war on terrorism, Clinton assured him. Karzai repeated his point. If the U.S. is only in Afghanistan for the war on terror, then he needed to partner with Pakistan. If the U.S. has a broader purpose, we will be with you, he added. Pakistan wants you out. Lute asked Karzai what he thought Pasha's latest offer of unconditional support to Afghanistan really meant. 2 months ago, Karzai answered, Pasha had said there were two preconditions for an agreement. Reduce or eliminate India's presence in Afghanistan, and create political accommodations for Pashtuns. The latter goal was implausible, Karzai had concluded, he said. It would be suicide for any Afghan leader to compromise on some of the political issues most important to Pakistan, such as the future of the Afghan-Pakistan border. Maybe Pakistan is not capable of changing, Clinton said. Maybe it needs enemies, so that the army and ISI could retain power. Karzai leaned in to the Secretary of State. What is your objective? He asked. Either you are with us forever, or I make a deal with Pakistan. By forever, Karzai explained, we want the same relationship as Israel, or at least the same as Egypt and South Korea. Those American allies enjoyed long-term defense guarantees and robust arms sales. Republicans and Democrats alike accepted those countries as essential allies. Was Afghanistan in the same category? There was no way for Clinton to answer Karzai's questions directly. It would have been awkward to explain, in any event, that the policy reviews undergirding Obama's dispatch of tens of thousands more U.S. troops to Afghanistan had actually concluded that the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons and the elimination of al-Qaeda on Pakistani soil were America's only truly vital interests in the region. The United States had declared publicly, again and again, its enduring commitment to Afghanistan. Yet it was highly doubtful whether Obama and bipartisan leaders in Congress regarded Afghanistan's importance as comparable to South Korea or Israel. They discussed the prospects for talking to the Taliban. How do we fight and die while also pursuing peace talks? Clinton asked. There were Taliban determined to be inclusive and take manpower away from the ISI, Karzai answered. These Taliban were all for peace without Al-Qaeda. With the conflict resolution cell now formed secretly at the White House, Richard Holbrooke's objective was to persuade Karzai to authorize direct contacts between the United States and the Taliban, as he now put it. But Karzai refused. Pakistan controlled the Taliban. Peace talks had to involve the ISI, Karzai believed. There was no other way, because the Pakistani service controlled the Taliban. He reached out to a tray before him. Picking up Mullah Omar for them is like picking up this cookie, Karzai said. The Taliban were just a bunch of country bumpkins, of no consequence without their Pakistani patrons, he added at another point. Holbrooke met separately during the visit with Hanif Atmar, the Afghan interior minister, whom Holbrooke had unsuccessfully promoted as an alternative to Karzai the previous year. The ISI believes that without Massoud, the Taliban will sweep through to power and take Kabul when the time is ripe, Atmar said. Holbrooke said that the problem was that in order to turn off the Taliban insurgency, Kayani probably wanted a civilian nuclear deal comparable to the one the Bush administration granted India, and also a major free trade agreement to lift Pakistan's economy. Yet these demands were politically unrealistic in Washington. To give Islamabad what it wanted is a deep impossibility, Holbrooke said. The Times Square attack was important, he went on, because the case history showed that the Pakistani Taliban now posed a direct threat to the U.S. homeland. The Afghan Taliban did not. Faisal Shahzad's phone numbers all led to the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban, not Al-Qaeda. Holbrooke asked Atmar the question that had been on his mind all year. Would the elimination of Mullah Omar change anything? No, Atmar predicted. The ISI would find a way to manage a leadership succession within the Taliban, he implied. After all the hours of preparation, after all the flags and flowers and one-on-one time with Karzai, the Afghan president's state visit left Clinton frustrated and sarcastic. Obama, Lute, and the National Security Council had displayed a mania for process, threads, resolution cells, and the like, Clinton complained to aides. I wouldn't do it this way if I were president, she declared pointedly. What was the end-state vision that the United States sought in Afghanistan? Clinton asked. That was perhaps why Karzai pressed so hard for Israel-like guarantees. Perhaps he sensed correctly that the Obama administration did not know the answer. Pakistan knows what end state they want, Clinton said. They've gotten more threatening to Afghanistan recently. They are letting loose the Haqqani network. But we don't know our end state vision because we don't have one. We don't have a Pakistan strategy or a reconciliation strategy. Just words and process. Ashfaq Kayani asserted that he was being misunderstood. His efforts to recruit Karzai into a separate peace negotiation might be competitive with Washington, but, in fact, American and Pakistani interests were compatible, he believed. To prove it, after Karzai's Washington visit, he said he was willing to talk to Karzai openly, with the United States in the room. McChrystal invited Kayani to Kabul on May 26th to spend time with Karzai alone, with the American general standing by to facilitate or mediate. By this time, McChrystal had warmed to the possibility of ending the war through a negotiated settlement. They didn't give me enough to win outright, he told an aide that spring, referring to troop levels, and Karzai's government is not going to win the battle of legitimacy. McChrystal did not think that the United States could settle the war, but he thought he might be able to set conditions for an agreement between Kayani and Karzai. Kayani flew in, bearing a concession. The general said that he would no longer describe Pakistan's goal as the establishment of a friendly government in Kabul. Pakistan would merely seek a stable, secure Afghanistan. Kayani regretted that his earlier statements about seeking a friendly Afghanistan had been heard as code for the Taliban's restoration. That wasn't his goal, he insisted. The army chief sold Karzai, who was glowing afterward, Ambassador Eikenberry reported to Washington. McChrystal's view was that Karzai and Kayani were moving ahead, as a pair, to find an understanding despite serious doubts among their advisers. Amrullah Saleh and Rangin Spanta were among those in Karzai's cabinet who opposed seeking a deal with Pakistan. Spanta felt that such an agreement had to be grounded in equality, and that Pakistan wanted to dictate its conditions to Kabul. In Islamabad, Pasha and ISI had their own doubts. Yet Kayani and Karzai showed that they want a relationship, in McChrystal's estimation. The CIA circulated analysis that month, reporting that Kayani has been pushing for reconciliation with Afghanistan since 2004, but that Musharraf had overruled him. Kayani was probing now for what kind of agreement might be possible. Pakistan doesn't know what its red lines are in pursuit of a deal, according to the CIA's take. If Pakistan's army could achieve by negotiations what it had tried and failed since the late 1980s to achieve by force, a stable Afghanistan that was not regarded by the Corps commanders as an ally of India, it might welcome all kinds of unlikely bedfellows in a political settlement, including the Panjshiris. Yet it was obvious that Kayani and Pasha remained hostile to some of the key figures in Karzai's security cabinet, particularly Amrullah Saleh. Karzai's own doubts were growing about Saleh, partly because of Saleh's close ties to the CIA. The Loya Jirga tent on the flowered grounds of Kabul Polytechnic University had become a symbol of a revived Afghanistan. The tent covered an area the size of a soccer field, serviced by a generator, and equipped with internet connections. That spring, Karzai organized a national consultative peace jirga at the tent complex. To symbolically engage more than 1,500 delegates around the possibility of negotiating with the Taliban. As with so much else, Karzai's approach was instinctive, tactical, and erratic, but also deft and hard to derail. He had fashioned international support for his peace initiative. The United Nations, Great Britain, and other European Union governments openly backed Karzai's search for a political solution to the war, even if they lacked faith in his ability to find one. On Wednesday, June 2nd, members of parliament, tribal leaders, businessmen, and activists streamed into the Loya Jirga tent. The men wore turbans, robes, and vests. Hundreds of women had also been named as delegates. Soon after they found their seats, explosions rang out. Taliban infiltrators fired rockets, inaccurately but loudly, at the Polytechnic campus. Four suicide bombers attempted to reach the assembly. Afghan police took heavy casualties, but shot several attackers dead before they could harm anyone, and later chased down other suspected conspirators. None of the peace delegates was injured. Yet the attack embarrassed and infuriated Karzai. The assembly went forward nonetheless. Karzai asked for a mandate for negotiations. He referred to the insurgents as Brother Talibanjan, a suffix indicating affection. He urged the Taliban to stop fighting and promised to push for peace step by step. On Sunday, June 6th, Karzai summoned Amrullah Saleh and Hanif Atmar, the interior minister, to the Arg Palace. Both men knew Karzai was furious about the failure of security, even though, in their opinion, the police and counter-terrorist squads they commanded had responded bravely and effectively. They both resented Karzai's public appeasement of the Taliban and his failure to celebrate the sacrifices of his own security forces. Atmar carried a resignation letter in his pocket. Ever since Holbrooke and Biden had promoted him as a possible presidential candidate, Karzai's insecurities had made Atmar's position as chief of Afghanistan's police and internal security less and less tenable. Saleh was in a mood similar to Atmar's. He was ambivalent about resigning, however, because he knew his departure from office was precisely what ISI wanted. That angered Saleh and made him more determined to stay. After they settled into their chairs, Karzai stunned them by declaring that he believed the attack on the peace jirga had been organized by the United States to undermine his search for a political settlement. "He knew this," he continued, "because during the hunt for fugitives involved in the attack, he had called McChrystal. The American commander had assured him that if he decided to continue with the jirga for 2 more days, McChrystal would make sure that the assembly would be secure." "Where did he get that confidence?" Karzai asked. "Because they were behind it. And as they saw that the jirga was not proceeding against their interests, they stopped the second episode of the attack and allowed the delegates to finish their work." Karzai added that he suspected Saleh and Atmar were part of the American conspiracy. Saleh told him he was wrong. They had enough evidence to be sure this was a Taliban operation, like many other suicide strikes in Kabul before. McChrystal's forces had chased down and arrested conspirators in Khost. "Do you think I'm stupid?" Karzai asked. "No, you are the president of the country," Saleh said. "Mr. President, you are going too far," Atmar intervened at one point. "First, this was not the Americans. Second, I am not complicit in this. I would not turn a blind eye." But when Atmar tried to say more, Karzai told him to shut up. At that, Atmar tossed his letter of resignation on the table. "You are not my commander-in-chief," he said. "I cannot serve you." Karzai turned to Saleh. "If Atmar is resigning, you should do the same." Saleh let a few seconds go by in silence. Then he agreed. "I don't have a written resignation," he said. "But for me, it's also enough." The two men left together. Saleh had concluded that Karzai had lost trust in NATO and sought to undermine the American military mission. This much seemed unarguable as the news of his resignation spread around Kabul that night. The Afghan cabinet's most hawk-eyed foe of ISI had been neutralized. On July 14, 2010, about 10 weeks after Faisal Shahzad's Pathfinder fizzled in Times Square, the Pakistani Taliban released a video. It showed Shahzad training with a machine gun and speaking to the camera while gripping a Quran. "I have been trying to join my brothers in jihad ever since 9/11 happened," he announced, somewhat implausibly. "I also want to inform my brothers Muslim living abroad that it is not difficult at all to wage an attack on the West, and specifically in the U.S., and completely defeat them." The video inflamed again American anger at Pakistan. This was turning out to be a less than congenial summer for strategic dialogue about a new American-Pakistani partnership. Yet Kayani persisted. He decided to write something more definitive and honest than the sterile Foreign Office white paper he had delivered to the White House earlier in the year. The general now drafted a second paper about Pakistan's requirements and strategic goals, a paper more in Kayani's own voice. It ran more than 100 pages. This became known as Kayani 2.0. It was fashioned as a think paper, as Holbrooke called it, providing a roadmap for the next 5 years. Kayani delivered it to the Obama administration on July 18th. Between the paper and Pasha's conversations with CIA counterparts, the Pakistanis advanced a more candid position than the deny, deny, deny lines of Musharraf vintage, such as, The Quetta Shura is a fiction. On counterterrorism, Kayani and Pasha offered a nuanced, if self-interested, argument. The CIA's drone war was driving the Afghan Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and the Haqqanis into closer cooperation, particularly in North Waziristan, the ISI feared. This was dangerous for both Pakistan and the United States. Yes, Kayani and Pasha said repeatedly, the ISI had contacts with the Haqqanis, but this was to gain influence and information, as surely fellow professional spies could understand. Pasha repeatedly pointed out to his CIA counterparts that the agency, too, maintained direct and indirect contacts with violent militias around the world to collect intelligence and develop influence. As for Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Kashmiri militant group that had struck Mumbai so devastatingly in 2008, it would be a mistake for ISI to break ties and drive it farther underground. Pasha said he could have prevented Mumbai if ISI had maintained closer contacts with Lashkar and the Directorate S officers involved had kept him, as the new chief, in the loop. The United States and India had no evidence that Pasha had personally known about Mumbai in advance. If the Obama administration wanted to change the calculus of the Pakistani public and elites, it would have to make bold bets on the country's independence, prosperity, and security. As one reader of the Kayani 2.0 paper summarized the general's evolving line of argument, "You Americans are just focused on the military and counterterrorism. You are running up against the hard limits of how far our relationship will go in these fields, and you are getting frustrated, and I'm sorry about that. But I have my realities, too. If you don't visibly address the big deficits in our economy, energy supplies, and water supplies, this relationship is just going to continue to be a muddle." On July 19th, as she began to digest Kayani's 2.0 white paper, Hillary Clinton gave a roundtable interview to Pakistani journalists. Her main purpose was to reinforce the strategic dialogue by talking about energy, water, Afghanistan, India, and the possibilities for mutual understanding. Yet when the questions turned to terrorism, Clinton laid out the risk of a total breach between America and Pakistan, perhaps war, if another attack such as the one at Times Square took place. If an attack is traced back to Pakistan, people in America will be devastated. Devastated, Clinton said. I cannot predict what the consequences would be, because there would be many people in the United States who would say, why did this happen? Why are we investing so much in our partnership? Kayani received this just as it was intended, as a threat. At the end of the month, he composed an anxious letter to Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I write to you at a critical juncture of our history, the August 2, 2010 typed confidential letter on Kayani's embroidered stationery began. For Pakistan, these are defining moments. He referred to the litany of recent statements made by the United States leadership, suggesting that any act of terror in the United States or anywhere else against the United States interests having links with terrorists in Pakistan will warrant a direct action by the United States against Pakistan. The letter continued, "These are very dangerous thoughts. I am sure you realize that any such action will jeopardize the very basis of our cooperation. It will push the Pakistan army to the wall and force me to take a position which may nullify our joint efforts of years made at such enormous costs. The consequences of such a scenario for overall security in the region are not difficult to predict. We must do anything and everything possible to avoid such a catastrophe." His reference to a scenario for overall security in the region carried an implied threat of his own. In the event of an American attack on Pakistan, his forces might abandon all constraint in backing the Taliban against American troops in Afghanistan. Kayani also seemed to interpret the American threats after Times Square as a kind of public pressure campaign designed to force him into pushing his army into action in North Waziristan. He wrote that he could not give in to this pressure because he lacked the political support in Pakistan to attack in Waziristan. If the United States broke with Pakistan or escalated its bombing in the country, he warned, there would be no return.